Davidson, and I'm with the McDivitt Law Firm, and here today representing the plaintiff appellant, Anita Rivera. And I thank the court for giving us this time to amplify upon the briefs previously filed. We'll try not to be redundant. As the trial court indicated in its order, it decided a fairly limited issue. There were a number of possible other issues that might have been addressed but were not addressed by the trial court. The trial court determined, as stated on the first page of its order, at issue is whether CRS 10-4-6091 allows stacking of the liability in UM portions of the policy, that is, the same policy, and prohibits the portion of the insurance policy which contractually bars payments under both the liability and UIM portions for the same injury. The trial court, as we all know, decided that the statute did not permit stacking of liability and underinsured motorist coverage of the same policy, and decided that the language in the insurance policy that by definition attempted to exclude coverage under the UIM portion of the policy where there had been coverage under the liability portion did not violate the statute. So that's a limited issue. Really, we're here to address is whether or not 10-4-609-1C allows stacking of liability and UIM coverage in the same policy, and whether or not the insurance policy language to the contrary is void because it's contrary to this statute and because it's contrary to the stated public policy of this state. We believe that the language of the statute is clear and unambiguous and should be read according to its plain, ordinary, everyday meaning. And I think there are several words within the statute that are particularly critical to the decision in this case. And primarily, the word any is the word that I'm looking at as being the critical wording in this statute. And although I don't like to read too much, I would ask the court's indulgence while I read the statute. It's short, and I think a reading will tend to help make my point. So, the coverage described in paragraph A of this subsection, that is relating to UIM coverage, shall be in addition to any legal liability coverage and shall cover the difference, if any, between the amount of the limits of any legal liability coverage and the amount of the damages sustained. Twice in the same sentence, the legislature emphasized that UIM coverage was to be an addition to any liability coverage. Didn't say any liability coverage from a separate policy. It said it shall be in addition to any liability coverage.
Mr. Davidson, let me ask you this.
Yes.
If your interpretation is right, then an individual injured by the policyholder here would have access only to the liability limits, not talking about a passenger now, let's talk about a third person. They would be able to access the liability limits, but not the UIM coverage. Would that be correct?
If this were a two-car accident,
yes,
I believe that would be correct, Your Honor.
So a passenger then in the vehicle, like Ms. Rivera was here, gets access to not only the legal liability limits, but also the UIM limits? And how does that make sense?
Well, Your Honor, it makes some sense, although it's not perfect. in my opinion. The idea behind the stacking law, if I may refer to it as that, is to provide the innocent injured party with, as far as possible, coverage from all sources up to the point it takes to make them whole. They're not entitled to duplicate payments, of course, and we don't argue that. You're only entitled to recover once for the same damages. But to the extent that there's any insurance out there to cover you up to the amount of your damages, it seems to me that what the legislature was doing when it passed Section 1C was to open the door to as much possible sources of recovery as might be had. Now, it's true that if someone is in another accident, they don't get advantage of the at-fault party's UIM coverage, perhaps. Probably not. I don't see how they would. They'd have to either rely upon their own UM or UIM coverage, if they had any, or UIM coverage of the driver of the car that they were involved with.
I know the definitions of underinsured and uninsured motorist coverage, I think, have been deleted by this amendment, if I'm not mistaken. But the general understanding of what an uninsured and underinsured motorist is that the legal liability limits have to be less than your own UIM coverage, correct? In order for a vehicle to be,
at least they have to be less, or you have to have settled in good faith for an amount less than the policy limits.
How is this vehicle then an underinsured vehicle?
Well, I think we no longer have the rule that in order to collect uninsured or underinsured motorists, that the policy limits have to be less. That was done away with when the legislature allowed stacking. And certainly before the legislature allowed stacking of coverage, you couldn't recover under your own underinsured motorist coverage unless it exceeded the amount of the liability coverage. I agree with that as a general principle. But that's no longer the case. As long as your damages exceed the amount you have recovered under your liability recovery, you can still collect under underinsured motorist coverage now. And I think that was the purpose of this very statute, was to open the door to people to have more access to possible sources of recovery up to the amount of their total damages. And the legislature was careful to say in here that there wasn't to be any kind of reduction in the amount you could recover from underinsured motorists for any other insurance coverage, whether it's health insurance coverage, whether it's other liability coverage, or whether it's other underinsured motorist coverage. You could go through all of those if your damages were substantial enough to justify it. And here, certainly, if this ever goes to trial on the merits, there'll be an issue, and it'll be plaintiff's burden to show that she is entitled to additional damages beyond that in the liability policy. But if she shows that, then I think the legislature has clearly demonstrated in enacting this amendment that it intends for an innocent victim to have recourse to any insurance available. And I understand the large leap from where the law was before the legislature enacted this amendment and where it's ended up afterwards. But I think the legislature didn't make that leap without looking first. And I think at least the legislature meant what it said. And I think that is supported by the fact that the legislature did make one exception to this otherwise universal rule in this very amendment, right in the middle of it. It did carve out a little exception, so it knew what it was doing. It could have made an exception such as is being sought here by American Family had it chosen to do so, but it made only one exception to the otherwise universal language of it shall be in addition to any legal liability coverage. Then in the next sentence, it did make this exception. A single policy or endorsement for uninsured or underinsured motor vehicle coverage issued for a single premium covering multiple vehicles may be limited to applying once per accident. So it did make that one single exception to what I think is an otherwise all-inclusive rule. And I think the very fact it made an exception is a strong indication that it didn't intend any other exception. It intended exactly what it said.
So, Mr. Davidson, when the statute says any other coverage, you're saying that doesn't mean necessarily only other coverage in other policies. It's any other coverage even within this own policy.
Correct, because they are separate coverages. This is other coverage. Liability coverage is one coverage. Underinsured motorist coverage is another coverage. I believe that's any other coverage. And again, the legislature said any other coverage, including but not limited to legal liability insurance, medical payments coverage, health insurance, or other uninsured or underinsured motor vehicles. I think it's important to say, when they said including but not limited to, incidentally. And if there are other questions, I'd like to take them, of course. If not, I'd like to save my time.
Quite on its initiative, raised a question of whether you had the correct policy. Is that significant here?
I don't think it makes any difference, Your Honor, although I think both Mr. Geislinger and I have egg on our faces, as well as the counsel in the trial court, but we simply both were guilty of an oversight. But there's no question but what in this policy there is, and quoting not from any place except the policy itself, there is language in which American Family definitely attempts to exclude coverage from uninsured motorist coverage in this situation. And that is page 1 of 9 discussing uninsured motorist bodily injury coverage. It gives definitions of an insured person. It does indicate that anyone occupying or using the insured's car is an insured person for uninsured motorist purposes, but it tries to exclude the vehicle, the owner's motor vehicle. It says uninsured motorist vehicles, however, does not mean a vehicle insured under the liability coverage of this policy. So as the trial court found, and as we agree, there is language in there that says American Family excludes a recovery under uninsured motorist provisions when it's paid out under its liability. The question is that policy language enforceable, or is it void because it's in violation of the statute and of our public policy, which has been demonstrated increasingly over the years, I think, and as I said before, with a great leap forward with the 2008 amendment, I think the public policy of this state is now pretty much that we want, as far as possible, to make an innocent injured victim whole. And we want to use any insurance out there to try to make that person whole.
Going back to my question, what I'm seeking from counsel, both sides, do you feel that we can resolve the substantive issues in this case despite the fact that, as you said, there was egg on everyone's face?
I do, Your Honor. I think the issue is, as the trial court framed it, simply whether or not this statute allows stacking of liability and UM/UIM coverage of the same policy, and whether or not the same statute voids the contractual language that purports to exclude that application of both liability and UIM coverage under the same policy. So, yeah, I think the issue, the basis of the court's opinion, was limited to deciding whether or not this statute permitted stacking of liability.
Mr. Davidson, you're severely over your time limit. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, I was just trying to ask.
I understand. I think you've answered the question.
Okay, well. Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate your indulgence. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is David Geislinger. My registration number is 15008. I am representing the defendant American Family in this case. I, too, want to first apologize for the egg on the face. And I want to put that in a little bit of context with what predecessor plaintiff's counsel and I were doing. If the court would look at the pleadings, we had pretty much come to an agreement that this was a legal issue, and that this was going to be a legal issue resolved by the trial court, and there was not a dispute that there was an exclusion within the policy. We had discussed, Mr. Haywood and I had discussed what the language was, and somehow that got placed in there. I do not believe that it does affect the ability of this Court of Appeals to resolve the issue, because this is a declaratory judgment action where the fact of the exclusion is admitted, and the question is whether or not the exclusion is void by the amendment to the statute. And I think that that's what Mr. Davidson and I tried to address in our joint response, which was filed with the court last week. So I do believe we're able to go with that.
I was trying to verify that.
Yeah, and I do think that if it wasn't stated in the joint response, or I believe we both agree that this is something that is available to the court because of the nature of the legal issue decided below. And I will share a couple of seconds with Mr. Davidson if he would concede to that.
Well, as I think I indicated, I am an
I think we.
Okay. So the parties stipulate.
The parties stipulate. Yeah, I think so. And the other thing that I do want to get to, and I think it was, there are a lot of legal issues and legal grounds that I cited. I think it's going to be very difficult for me to get through all of them in 15 minutes, so I'm going to advise the court in advance. If there is something in particular that you want me to move on with or get to, by all means, please do so. I think we start with the fundamental question. If the statutory amendment does not statutorily overrule Terra Nova, then Terra Nova is still controlling law. And as controlling law, the exclusion within the policy is binding on the parties. It is not void against public policy. And throughout the brief, I went through several reasons why I do not believe the statute overrules Terra Nova. First and foremost is it's a very obtuse and indirect way for overruling Terra Nova if that's in fact what the legislature intended to do. What the legislature clearly intended to do, and American Family's not making an argument to this effect, is that where there is UIM coverage in addition to other coverage, the claimant is now entitled to stack those coverages if they meet the factual predicate for doing so. The question, though, is there coverage of for UIM or UM under these circumstances, and there is not. It is an exclusion under these circumstances within the policy. The Terra Nova Court, in its decision, said there's no coverage there, and it is within the rights of the insurer to contract for no coverage in these circumstances. And I'm not going to go through Terra Nova unless the court wants me to, because I think the court has read it. Both counsel addressed that to this point. I do think Terra Nova is dispositive. If we then take it the next step, the question is, this is an admitted, clear, and unambiguous exclusion at the trial court and at the Court of Appeals. The question all is that exclusion rendered void? Starting with the policy language or the admission that there's a clear and unambiguous exclusion in the policy, case law is very clear that the next question is if the exclusion is there, it's enforceable unless it's void as against public policy. And I think in this distinction, in this, at this point, it's important to distinguish, I think, between the intent of the statute, which, as I read it, is to avoid insurance companies who owe an obligation from setting that obligation off when the injured person is compensated from another source of insurance, versus an insurance company's right to exclude coverage under certain circumstances. This is not a set-off. The statute is designed to allow setting or to deny insurers the right to set off obligations. This is an exclusion, and a contract exclusion means there's no coverage to begin with. Ergo, no coverage to set off. Once Ms. Rivera gets paid, or under the facts of this case, she is entitled to make a claim against Ms. Cavillo through her insurance company for the policy limits. She is paid that. There is nothing to set off, and there's no coverage. So I do think it's important to recognize the distinction between a set off and an exclusion. And it's interesting, in his reply brief, or in her reply brief, appellant cites Newton versus Nationwide, and I reviewed that case. In Newton, a policy provision which constituted a set-off of PIP benefits was deemed to be in violation of the statute and therefore unenforceable. But at the conclusion of its reading, the Supreme Court wrote that the proper way to handle this is to, quote, eliminate PIP paid benefits from the uninsured motorist claim, unquote. Eliminate is another word for exclude. Even in Nationwide, the Supreme Court was pointing out a set-off is legally impermissible and void against public policy, but an exclusion is not. It wasn't that the Supreme Court said that the uninsured motorist had to pay twice for the PIP benefits. The way that they tried to avoid doing that by setting off was impermissible. The Supreme Court said, write an exclusion. And that's what American Family did here. The distinction, legal distinction between set off and exclusion is contained in the brief, and I would refer to that. And then we talked about whether the amendment overrules Terra Nova or not. By implication, at least, Judge Samuelson said it did not. There is a lot of discussion of appropriate means to interpret statutes and statutory intent when it comes face to face with the claim that a judicial precedent has been specifically overturned by the legislature. In here, none of those are present. The language that was used, the substantive language in Terra Nova, was left unchanged. The incomplete legislative control of UM/UIM law in the state is still an incomplete statement per Terra Nova, because it is still a voluntary coverage that people can purchase. The only portion that was modified wasn't really, in Terra Nova, wasn't really a substantive modification. It was to harmonize that section with the section that was previously amended so as to allow stacking. And that's what the legislature intended to do. There is no overwhelming evidence of a legislative intent to overrule Terra Nova, and this court, I think, therefore, is bound by Terra Nova. It's up to the Supreme Court to overrule it legally. It's up to the legislature to say, we want to overrule Terra Nova, if, in fact, that's what their intent is. The majority interpretation is referred to by the Terra Nova court as the better reasoned cases. And then there's a lot of discussion about all the policy reasons behind that majority interpretation that validates this kind of exclusion. They range the gamut from the purpose of UIM is to protect from the conduct of a driver other than the driver in which the passenger is injured. It constitutes, to do what the plaintiff wants, constitutes judicial rewriting of insurance contracts because it, in effect, converts what is UIM first party claims that a passenger, because of her status as a passenger, may be able to make to the driver's policy to a second tier of liability coverage with regard to the driver. And I think in terms of basic, you know, contract law, it's important to recognize that typically an insurance company in a UIM claim gets to have the right of action to the extent of UIM payments against the tortfeasor. That can't happen here because the tortfeasor is the insured. So what they're plaintiff is actually asking for is a situation where there is not only a second tier of liability coverage, there is a second tier of liability coverage ordinarily for which the insurance company has a right of subrogation, but because an insurance company can't subrogate against its insured, that is written into the policy. So it's also rewriting the subrogation portion of the UIM claim by doing that. That the overwhelming majority reasons legislatures contemplate two distinct policies of two distinct drivers, which I think if you go to the statute's reading of description of types of other insurance, it doesn't include this policy. And if the legislature wants to overrule Terra Nova, it will say all coverage, including any other coverage in this policy. But of course, it's excluded, so there's no coverage to begin with.
Does the policy itself contain a definition of underinsured and uninsured motorist coverage?
I'm not sure about coverage. It does contain a definition of uninsured and underinsured car. And by exclusion, the rest of the portion that we cited, the court correctly noted the one part, the definition excludes a car covered by the liability portion of that policy. So there's the majority interpretation recognizes that several of the cases, the statutes are, or the policies are all different. There's also an exclusion for a car that's available for Ms. Cabillo's regular use. This car is listed on the declaration sheet as available for her regular use, so that's a second reason for an exclusion. There's a lot of definitions in there. I don't know if it has a definition. I think we submitted the whole policy to the underlying court. I don't know if it has a definition of underinsured motorist claim off the top of my head, and I apologize for that. I think the other thing in the majority interpretation is a case that was recently decided by the state Supreme Court, which is Apodaca versus Allstate, 255 P3rd 1099. And I cited that case for a couple of reasons. One is plaintiff asserts that there is this, and defendant recognizes a general policy to make coverage where it is available as expansive as possible. The Supreme Court was, in our state, was faced with the prospect of deciding whether there was coverage in a UIM-UM instance where there was a an umbrella policy, and recognized that general tendency. But the Supreme Court said there's no coverage there. Because there's no coverage, we don't extend the policy to find coverage where there is none. And then it said something really interesting. While a traditional auto liability policy protects an insured from liability to third parties, uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage is not liability insurance in any sense. And what we have here is a desire to make uninsured or underinsured motorist coverage a second tier of liability coverage that was recognized as the attempt in Terra Nova and prohibited. That is recognized as an intent in the majority of this vast majority of cases and is rejected. And our Supreme Court in the last several months reiterates UM, UIM is different. One of the things we don't know if Ms. Rivera purchased her own UM UIM policy. The statute allows persons to purchase UM UIM to protect themselves in this kind of situation. Ms. Rivera is not a party to the Cavillo policy. She has no expectations to the Cavillo policy. And so whether she chose to purchase UM, UIM coverage on her own, that's her choice, but American Family is permitted to exclude UM, UIM coverage in these circumstances. Thank you.
Both for your arguments this morning. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.